David is making his way as king. Abner had been kind of helping to run Israel, Ishbosheth, remaining son of Saul. Abner's been murdered, Ishbosheth assassinated, and so Israel's come to David to make him king, and so we'll see that here in 2 Samuel 5. But things are going to look really good for a few chapters here with David. I'm excited about that. It's always nice to talk about some pleasant things. But we'll keep in view this picture of the kingdom and kind of where we are in the story of the Bible. David is, he's important to the Bible story for what reason? What reasons?
He's a type of Jesus.
He's a type of Jesus. Everything's going to be about Jesus. So we're going to see that David fills out this picture of Jesus a little bit. In what way is David a type of Jesus? By the way, when we say type, what does that word mean? Not just that he's a kind of Jesus, but what else? Amos?
Like, he's a shadow of Jesus.
Yeah, that's another word that gets used, right? Is a shadow of Jesus.
Example.
I'm sorry?
An example.
Yes, Mary?
Well, it's foreshadowing Jesus in a way where, like, we see characteristics of who Jesus will be, but it's an imperfect Jesus.
Right, yeah. So that's a great way to put it. So type and anti-type, sometimes we use that phraseology. And it's a term you would use from printing, but even with in this day where they're writing things and you'd have stamps, if you have a seal, you know, like a seal, like a signet ring, that's not what the seal looks like, right? It's the reverse image, and so you don't see it until you actually put it in the wax or in the clay, and then you bring it out. It's like, ah, that's what it looks like. And so from printing press days, Benjamin Franklin here, and he's working the printing press, and they're putting in the typeface. I used to imprint Bibles, and you had to think through, okay, what's this going to look like? Because you can't just put it in, like you read it, and then plop it down, then it's going to be upside down mirror image. So Jesus is the perfect image. But then you'll get people like Moses, or Joseph, or David, and they are types of Christ, but they're imperfect. So there are things about David that help us to see Jesus more clearly. So, what is a way in which David is a type of Christ? Just give me a couple real quick. Dale?
He honored God and didn't strike down Saul when he could.
Okay, yeah. He loves his enemies and offers forgiveness. And so there's a something of the character of Jesus in David. Ready?
Leadership?
We need a king. And so David is this king, and he comes from shepherding sheep. And doesn't Jesus, I am the shepherd, and so he comes, and like David, he's taken from the sheepfolds to be king. Noah?
He loves God. He really loves God despite his weaknesses and his mistakes, and he really tries to do the will
yes.
of God.
David is called by God a man after God's own heart, and if he was, then certainly Jesus is. Amos?
Well, also, Saul was a bad king, and so him being the good king compared to Saul and Jesus having a lot of bad leadership before him.
Yeah, every king who's come before Jesus is a failure in comparison to Jesus. They never give us ultimately what we need. They might be successful in some worldly sense, or even in a sense of morality and serving God, still might be a success in some way, but they don't go all the way. And so we need Jesus to be the king that God gives us. David?
I'm thinking Psalm 38, verse 11. My lovers and my friends stand aloof, but my sword, my kinsmen stand afar. I'm just thinking about, especially from what we see later on,
yes.
Especially after the assembly last year.
Right.
The people that he would like to be close to him, actually against him, especially.
Yes. Yeah, you can see a lot in the Psalms where David's speaking out of his circumstances, out of his emotions, and then later you'll look at the life of Jesus and see, wow, that is so much richer, but it's the same thing what we saw with David. So excellent point. Donnie?
Yeah, the fact that David is from the tribe of Judah, and Jesus is also from the tribe of
right.
Judah. I see that similarity. But while I was just thinking about it, I also think about Jesus in Gethsemane, when the night, when of course the decision to be made
right.
was upon him, and he says, "Not my will,
right.
but your will be done."
Right.
Think of David when he knew that his child,
yeah,
and the situation that he was in, he was praying. But he knew ultimately
right.
it was the will of God.
Yeah.
That when he got the news, everybody was amazed at how it is that he was, you know, and all of a sudden he gets up and it's like nothing.
Right.
You know, so
you see this perfect surrender
yeah.
to God's
yeah.
plan. And like Meredith said, it, you know, what David does there is impressive, but that's for the death of his child, and then Jesus is entrusting God with his own life. And
yeah.
so you're right, it's taken even further with that. Meredith, you had a hand up.
Thinking the same thing that Donnie was saying, that in general, David followed God's plan even when it was difficult.
Right.
Or he was scared. And we saw times when Jesus was scared or nervous, but still did it.
Right, right. Yes, you see this trust in God. Two more, Amos and then Noah.
Well, maybe even just God making a house for David, or David wanting to make a house for God, and Jesus making a home for his people.
Yes, excellent. And we'll see that in John 2, and the idea of tearing down this temple, rebuilding it in 3 days, the house of David fulfilled in that. And so those are all shadows and types that point forward to Jesus. So yeah, the life of David is rich with that sort of thing. No?
Also,
get the last
David
word.
Is an important link in on the plan to bring the Savior into the world.
Yes. Yeah, you get from Matthew's telling of the genealogy, you get Abraham and then David and Zerubbabel, and finally we get to Jesus. Excellent. So the life of Jesus, we're going to see kind of in pictures as we study the life of David. So we want to do two things as we're doing this, like we do throughout the Old Testament, is we want to see the Old Testament story. We want to see the point that the Spirit is making through those writers to that particular audience. But then also keep in view the larger audience and the larger message of the Bible as a whole. So we'll do those two things at the same time. And you guys are good at that, right? You can do two things at the same time. Right, Julian? Yeah, okay. All right, so we're in 2 Samuel 5. And David is being established as a king. So let's read verses 1 through 10, please. And get a volunteer to read that.
Everyone's looking down except Elijah. Go ahead.
Starting in verse 1, chapter 5. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with him at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and at Jerusalem he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. Through 10.
Mm-hmm.
And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, 'You will not come in here, but the blind and the lame will ward you off,' thinking, 'David cannot come in here.' Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. And David said on that day, 'Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him go up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul.' Therefore it is said, 'The blind and the lame shall not come into the house.' And David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built the city all around from the millow upward, inward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him."
All right, excellent. So the people finally come to David and say, "We want you to be king." And what reasons do they give for wanting David as king? Amos?
"Behold, we are your bone and flesh."
All right, we're relatives, so we can depend on you. Better to have a fellow Hebrew as a king than to have a Moabite or Ammonite or Egyptian, someone like that, as king. We're not going to pay tribute to some ruler. All right? What else? What are the reasons? Alex?
We've already seen how well David rules and how he trusts God when he has a problem. And so they talk about how in verse 2, in times past when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in.
Yes.
And the Lord, so he's appointed by God, and he's the one who,
yes,
even when Saul was king, he's the one who's kind of helping them figure out where they need to go and what they need.
It seems like everyone understands David is the God-appointed leader. I wish that were the reason they come to David. They say, God made you king, so come be king. But they're kind of dragging their feet about it with Abner and Ishbosheth, and now that those guys are dead, I guess we better get a king. So they go to David, and they go back with his track record. All this time that Saul was our king, who was it that was leading us and defending us? It was you, David. And so you've got some good success here. We want that. And so they do mention the Lord's appointed you. I kind of see that that is maybe not their focus. I wish it were, but that's part of it. Meredith, you have a follow-up?
Okay.
Anything else about why they chose David as king, wanted to be king? Elijah?
It seems interesting that they said, behold, we are your bone and flesh, when in reality, Saul was literally of the tribe of Benjamin, and it seems like we see the people who were of the Benjamites coming to David. Saul was also their kinsman, but it seems they're also focusing on, okay, this is a man who sympathizes with those who are in trouble, who feels for, he was chased by Saul, and we saw when he was in the wilderness, other people come to him who were in trouble, so he understands their sorrows, he understands the things they're going through, and I think that's more than just a reference to the physical qualities, but also his mental, emotional qualities. He can feel for them. He has not just sympathy, but also empathy with them.
Yeah, that's a good distinction. Is David, David was a man of the people, and he understood. David is, in some ways, one of the, when he's doing well, he's one of the least kingly kings, because he just doesn't, you know, he doesn't really expect a lot of people to show him great honor. He's humbling himself. We'll see that even in the section today. But he's just a very humble man. But he is a kingly king, don't get me wrong. But he just, yeah, he's someone who the people, this guy gets us. He knows us. Okay? Now, Donnie?
Okay. Why I was for the fact that David is anointed as king, right? By Samuel. Then comes Saul, who has not accepted his rejection from God.
Right.
Was always still in the picture.
Right.
So to speak. Then comes the issue with son and king. And yet, like you said, he's humble enough that he doesn't assert himself
right
over. He could have killed Saul and Atis on Toki.
Right.
And in fact, when Saul gets killed, he actually kills the person who because, again, of that respect that he had for
right
God's appointment, so to speak. You come to this point and you recognize that you think of God and the fact that Israel as a nation wanted a king,
right,
like all the other nations, right? Yet, you realize that heavily, in some ways, the people decides, even God has chosen.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So, but all in all, David, free all, has, like you said, has been humble. And finally, the people is around him, and he begins to, you know, rule in
yeah
Jerusalem. So, again, that speaks to the, I always wonder about God saying, David is man after my own heart, but it's moments like this, when you look at this picture, it really hits you that, hey, you know, there's a likeness.
Yes, yeah, he is humble like God. He has this character that I think portrays something of God's character. Excellent point. So they anoint him as king in Hebron again. He's 30 years old, he begins to reign. He reigns for 40 years. The first 7.5 years, he's in Hebron. We mentioned last time the importance of Hebron. It is kind of the birthplace of the family of Abraham. Remember, Abraham's family cemetery, if you will. It's there in the cave, Machpelah, there around Hebron. And this is a pretty important place for the people of Israel. And it's in Judah. But now he's going to move toward Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is a little more central. It's still in Judah, but it's like on the border of Benjamin, which is helpful. And it's going to be less about Judah and more about the nation. There are some other reasons, though, why Jerusalem is so important as a city. It's called the Stronghold of Zion in verse 7. And so if you look at Jerusalem on a map, if you get some ancient maps, if I thought about it, I would have put that on the slide. Right, okay, well, there you go. But it is surrounded by three different valleys. And so it is a stronghold in the truest sense. Anyone who's going to attack this place is going to have a hard time getting to it. Which is why the Jebusites who have it, they say, can't come up here. Even the, how confident are they?
The blind and the lame will ward you off.
Yeah. Our soldiers, we're going to put our guards off duty, and our blind beggars, we're going to come out and put them on the walls to defend our city against you, David. Yeah. Okay, and that's the picture. Very, very confident here. Now, Jerusalem, who are these people, by the way, who live in Jerusalem right now? The
Jebusites.
And so formerly, Jerusalem was called Jebus. And so if you go back and read in the book of Joshua, you'll see that. However, Jebus was conquered by the tribe of Judah. So there's something that's happened here, where they come in, they conquer it, drive out the Jebusites, and probably one of two things happened. The Jebusites at some point attacked back and retook the city, or what else might have happened? What did the Hebrews often do, the Jews often do? Just kind of leave them out there. Just not completely destroy or completely push them out. And so at some point the Jebusites like, do you mind if we just, you know, you're here, we're here, we'll just kind of like hang out together, and then slowly, and then they take over again. And you see, that's a lot of times Satan's ploy, is he doesn't, you know, want to cause trouble. He just kind of sneaks back in, and eventually you look around and go, wait, when did he take over? When did sin get a grip on my life like this? So you get this re-infiltration of the Jebusites, and they are in charge of the city. Jerusalem, though, goes even further back than that. Does anybody remember a further back history of Jerusalem? Get bonus points. Amos, you want bonus points?
It was the king who was also a priest who blessed Abraham when he came through.
And his name was, we'll help him out, the king who was priest. Reason knows it, right, Reason? Donnie helped you. Melchizedek. Melchizedek, remember, his name means king of righteousness, right? Zedek, right? No, Melech. Melech is king. Remember, like Abimelech, right? And then Zedek is righteousness. So he's king of righteousness, and Salem was the city where he reigned over in Genesis 14, means peace. And so he's king of Shalom, right? And so you've got the king of peace, king of righteousness, but he's also priest of God Most High. So this is a really interesting place. Very rich history, very, very, very old city. Even in David's day, this city is 1,000 years old. So it's old city. Okay. So they're going to take Jerusalem and set up a kingdom here. And so he says, if anybody wants it, you can go up and take it, go up the water shaft. We don't know precisely which water shaft, but archaeologists have discovered water shafts that go up through the walls of Jerusalem. And you can go there today. It's called Warren's Shaft. And again, I neglected to get a slide together for that. I should have. But there's the water shaft. It's not mentioned in 2 Samuel, but it is mentioned in Chronicles. And let me just mention this very briefly. Do you know what 1 and 2 Samuel is called in the Septuagint? It's called 1 and 2 Kings. So you know what 1 and 2 Kings is called in the Septuagint?
1 and
2
Samuel?
Well, no. 3 and 4 Kings. So you've got just, really, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings is one story. And so where does Chronicles come in? These four books, if you will, these four, I don't know what I'm doing with my fingers here, the four books of 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings is really, that's a unit. and in Chronicles. And so it's helpful to know who is the audience of each. Well, you say Israel, right? Yes, but Kings is answering this question. As an exile in captivity, why are we in captivity? Because you get to the end of Kings and you realize that the Israelites are in captivity. And there's this really interesting chapter in 2 Kings 17 that explains why the northern kingdom is taken away and why the southern kingdom is about to be taken away. And so all this is leading up to, this is why the kingdom fails. Think about it. 1 Samuel begins with, we need a king, we need a king, God give us a king. And how does Saul go? Bad. And David? Good king. But you read 2 Samuel, how does it end up? Not great either. In fact, when we're going to get into 1 Kings, you know how we're introduced to David in 1 Kings? He's an old man, and he can't even get warm. He is so old and so tired that the Goliath giant killer is gone. And now we just have this man who can't even plan for the future of his kingdom. His wife has to come in and say, do you remember when we said that Solomon would be the next king? He said, oh yeah. And they have to hire this maiden to come and help keep him warm, a nurse. What happened to David? And it's just showing what happens to the kingdoms of men. And so 1st, 2nd Kings follows that. Chronicles, however, doesn't highlight the failures of David. It pictures David as the great king. And it's saying to not the captives who are in captivity, but the captives who've come back from captivity, what do we need? What are we looking forward to? We need a David. We need a new king. We need a new ruler. We want to go back to this heyday. God, give us, restore the kingdom. And that's right, but it's not going to be, David. God promises that I'm sending you David. It's not David. It's going to be Jesus. So Chronicles is not going to talk about David's failure so much. You won't read about David and Bathsheba in Chronicles. But in Chronicles, it tends to highlight more the good decisions that David makes. Who is someone bad right now who's working with David? We kind of talked about him. He's like, oh, why is he even there? Joab. Why is Joab not a great guy? No, no, I'm talking to you. Go ahead.
Because he keeps doing things like that he thinks are good for David.
Right.
He's
almost usurping authority and like, I know David said to do this, make peace with Abner, but I'm going to go kill Abner. And he keeps making decisions that are violent, that overreach his authority, and David just kind of keeps him on. So like, why does he let Joab hang on? Well, Chronicles, at this moment, says, whoever goes up the shaft, the water shaft into Jerusalem to take it, let him be commander of the army. Imagine being Joab, the commander of the army, and David has just announced, whoever wants to be commander of the army, I'm the commander of the army. Job opening. Suddenly Joab has to go, well, if I'm going to stay commander of the army, then I better be the one to go up the water shaft. And that's why in Chronicles you see Joab going up the water shaft to help take Jerusalem, because he has to re-secure his job position. And so in Chronicles, David is shown to try to kind of like get rid of Joab in some ways. Samuel just points out they're coming to Jerusalem. So I mentioned that as you look at Kings and you look at Chronicles, remember the audience. It really helps to see what is the major message. In Chronicles, David is highlighted for his good qualities, which he has several. In Samuel and Kings, we just see the failure of these earthly rulers. Right? Thoughts or questions about that? Amos?
Why does David say that like he hates the blind and the lame, and he takes in Mephibosheth?
Does he say he?
He says it in verse 8, whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind who are hated by David.
Yeah, sorry, that's easy to misunderstand. He's speaking tongue-in-cheek. Okay, he's being a little sarcastic here. Because the blind and the lame are the Jebusites. They live in the city. They're saying, weak people could defend you. And so David's saying, go get those people. Go get the Jebusites. And so he's calling the Jebusites the blind and lame. He doesn't mean the literally blind and lame. He's saying, go attack the Jebusites. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny thing to say here. Mary.
Just
Not to digress, but then you have the author of the Kings, the author of the Chronicles, who would we know who would have?
That's a great question. That we
and
don't.
And like, timeline-wise, like,
yeah.
Were they written around the same time? Were they written in separate times?
They're written at separate times. And it's likely that Samuel starts some of the work that makes it into 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and Kings.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he dies partway through 1 Samuel. And then it's likely that Jeremiah helps with 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and Kings at some point. But there's a lot of mystery around who's there. Jeremiah, of course, is a prophet when Judah is taken into captivity. And so we kind of link Jeremiah with the Kings, as well as Lamentation, as he's writing things around that time. Ezra is a good candidate for Chronicles. And so Ezra the scribe, he's doing a lot of teaching, a lot of recording. But this is probably the work of several prophets who are helping to tell the story of God's people at that time.
Because it is interesting that you point out how like Kings is highlighting like the failures along with some of the good things that they did. But Chronicles really does shed a lot more positive light.
Yes.
And even like later on you get to Manasseh, who's the most evil of them all. But in Chronicles, he gets redemption.
Yes.
You know, he comes back to the world.
Right.
You don't see any of that in Kings.
Right.
So
yeah.
It's interesting.
That'll be really fun to highlight when we get to the divided kingdom, because there's a lot of stuff like that. And even when we get to the construction of the temple, but we'll see that as well. Yeah, it's fascinating to look at the differences. A lot of times when we get to the divided kingdom, we want to read Kings and Chronicles together. And that's useful, but it's kind of like reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John together. That's useful, kind of a harmony of the Gospels. But Matthew has a message, and so does Mark, and so does Luke, and so does John. All right, excellent, great. All right, so they go up, they take the city, and David becomes greater and greater. And there's this fella named Hiram in verse 11 and 12 who sends messengers to David to help build him a palace. We're going to see Hiram later, the king of Tyre. He helps to build what? The temple. And so Hiram is going to be a helper with Solomon building the temple. So David is becoming established not just nationally, but internationally. So these kingdoms around about are showing respect and honor to David. And then we see that he also advances even in his home. And this is a little note. Remember what we said, 1 2 Samuel, 1 2 Kings. There are a lot of good things about David, but we're also seeing things that we go, why? Because what does David do in 13 through 16? Concubines. All right. You already had a bunch of wives and a lot of kids. Now you're getting concubines. Okay, these concubines are going to show up later in the story in 2 Samuel. Elijah.
I don't want to read anything that's not there into the text, but in 13 through 16, God is not mentioned at all in that paragraph, and we had just seen God mentioned in both 11 through 12 and 1 through 10. So in both of those sections, David says he knows that God is with him in this. But then 13 through 16, through 16, there's just no mention of God.
Yeah, and I think you're right. We don't want to read too much into that. The emphasis here, if we can kind of pause on, is this good, is this bad? The emphasis in verse 12 is that the Lord is establishing him as king. And so this is kind of a time to say, wow, look how successful God is making David. The whole kingdom is coming to him, Israel and Judah. He's building a house with the help of Hiram, king of Tyre, and his family is growing. And so looking at it generally like that, you go, wow, God's establishing him. But being a little more discerning, you look at this and go, I don't know if this is very wise. This is very godly. And you're going to have to tuck those away and come back to them. Donnie?
Yeah, what I like about this historical narratives is the fact that As a man of God, writing about a man of God, it doesn't hide the flaws. It shows the humanity.
Yes.
Which helps us as Christians to understand that God is not finished with us.
Yes.
There are still flaws that we even have
to
navigate to get to where we need to be.
Yes, right.
And it's encouraging. You know, it's not a book that sort of show them only as heroes.
Right. Yeah, it's a realistic look at some real people. Most myths don't do that. They sort of create this perfect alabaster skin beauty of a king and queen, right? And the Bible leaves the warts on. And so that is helpful David, as a savior of the people, isn't going to be all that he should be. But he's not a failure as a man because God is gracious. He's going to fulfill his plan through Jesus. So I think an excellent point to bring up. Amos?
Hiram is like the house builder for kings. He helps to build the house for God and the house for David. He's hardly talked about, but he seems like a good man going for God.
Yeah, Hiram's an interesting character. Tyre is a very wealthy city, and a lot of merchants pass through here. So he has access to a lot of resources. So we'll pay attention to him later. Now, David is going to defeat the Philistines and just break their strength around them, strike them down through verse 25. And so just highlighting his further successes. But to continue here, we've got to get through chapter 6, Lord willing. They're going to bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. Now, the Ark of the Covenant normally stays where? Yeah, in the tabernacle. And the word... What did she say?
I don't know.
Oh. Wanting this out?
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Well, God bless her. All right, so thank you for being here. This is an opportunity. And I hope that we all appreciate people that come by and see. Like, there are people sometimes that just stand out here and watch and are encouraged. This is an opportunity people can walk in. So be ready to grab the opportunity. Okay, so Ark of the Covenant is usually the tabernacle. What's the point of the Ark of the Covenant?
The presence of God.
The presence of God. It is sort of the portable...
throne
for God. Like the Lord is enthroned above the cherubim, right? Now, where is the tabernacle now? Amos?
The Philistines had taken the tabernacle in battle, but then they had trouble with it and sickness broke out on them, and so they sent it back to the Israelites. But then some of them were sick and they were struck dead, so they just left it there.
Yeah, that is the right story for the Ark of the Covenant, right? So the Ark of the Covenant, remember, they took it into battle. The Israelites said, we're losing the Philistines, so let's take our secret weapon and go in and have God tag along with us. Never a good idea to ask God to tag along with you. And so they lose the Ark of the Covenant. But the tabernacle, the tent that the Ark of the Covenant was housed in, it's still in use, but it's been separated from the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant is being kept by this family, and so God is establishing David as king. The nation is getting this new center, and so David sees the need to bring the king near. It's not just about David being king. David recognizes who the real king is, so he's going to bring the Ark of the Covenant. But there's a problem. Let's read verse 6, 1 through 15 here. And... Can I volunteer to read? Someone wants to read 1 through 15? Mike? All right, 1 through 15.
Now David again gathered all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people who were with him to Baal Judah to bring from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name, the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim. They placed the Ark of God on a new cart, that they might bring it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new cart. So they brought it with the Ark of God from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and Ahio was walking ahead of the Ark. Meanwhile, David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made of firewood and with lyres, harps, tambourines, castanets, and cymbals. But when they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the Ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen nearly upset it. And the anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence. and he died there by the ark of God. David became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. So David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the ark of the Lord come to me?" And David was unwilling to move the ark of the Lord into the city of David with him, but David took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom and the Gittites. Thus the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom and the Gittites 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. You said 15.
Yeah, doing great. And you're getting practice saying that name, right?
Yes. Now it was told King David, saying, "The Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him on account of the Lord of the Ark of God." David went and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom into the city of David with gladness. And so it was that when the bearers of the Ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling. And David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord and shouting, with shouting and the sound of the trumpet.
Great. So, 1 Chronicles 13, 15, 16 also gives some details about this. They're important. But from 2 Samuel's perspective, remember every book has its message, so the message of 2 Samuel, they bring the Ark of the Covenant. And the text emphasizes what the Ark of the Covenant is. It is the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord of hosts, who sits enthroned in the cherubim. So in case we've forgotten what this thing is, it's not just a gold box. It is very, very special to God. Just like this is not just a metal circle. I have very strong feelings about this particular metal circle. If I walk out on the sidewalk and there's just a metal washer on the sidewalk, that's just a metal washer on the sidewalk. If I lose this, I'm going to be upset. My wife will be upset. She loves me, we'll get over it, but this is important. But if I lose it, not just because there was an accident, but because I was being careless and dismissive of our marriage, I took it off for some selfish reason, and then lose it. So picture the Ark of the Covenant this way. This is it's the Ark of the what?
Covenant.
So what's that describing?
This is the covenant between God and man, and this is his dwelling place.
This is all about this relationship between God and the Hebrew people, and they've lost it. And they've had it back now for a couple decades, and it's just been kept away. And David says, "Let's bring it back." And so what do they do with it?
They put it on the, we've got new technology, let's put it on this cart.
Well, yeah, I don't know if carts were new technology, but it was a new cart. It's a new cart. So, you know, at least they, you know, kind of make this a special occasion. Noah's back here shaking his head. What's wrong, Noah?
But they were told how to transport the ark, okay, and they didn't listen to it.
Okay.
And because of it,
okay. Chronicles really emphasizes the fact that the Levites, and David gets onto them and says, "You were supposed to carry this thing." If we just read Samuel, if you're a king or you're a queen and you're coming in, you might ride a chariot, but normally you're going to be carried in on a litter. And that's kind of what the Ark of the Covenant is. And where does the baggage go? On a cart. The Ark of the Covenant is not being treated with the same kind of value and respect that it deserves, that God deserves. And so the carrying picture, if you go back and look at the tabernacle and the instructions about it in the book of Exodus and the book of Numbers, there were certain things that they had carts for. The curtains of the tabernacle, the structure of the tabernacle. But when it came to the furniture itself, it was all to be carried. Donnie?
Story and wonder what God. Wow, God is so bad.
Yeah.
Because these guys were just trying to help.
Just trying to help.
And you know, they were destroyed.
But it wasn't until later on, you know, for study, I came to recognize, as was said, you know, God had given them the manner, the pattern that they ought to, when carrying.
Right.
And David later on realizes, he realized, as vexed as he was, we did not do it according to the due order.
Right.
But what is interesting to note is that in from verses 17 to 25, you see that David is going to God, and he has this relationship. God is guiding him in terms of the battle against the Philistines, right? He goes to God, inquires on that.
Right.
Now, something as significantly important as the act and transporting, you don't go to God, you do it by yourself.
Right.
So God has protected him against the Philistines. But here it is, you are actually carrying the presence of God and you don't go to God.
Yeah.
And you make this decision. And here, and what happens?
There's some presumption here.
Yeah.
Should have inquired the Lord, should have sought, how do we do this? They're trying to honor God. But really, if you're trying to honor God, and this is for today too, how does God want to be honored? What has God said that he wants us to do? And so think about it this way. If my wife has told me, you know, for my birthday this year, here's what I'd like, which Lindsay hardly ever does. She's never like, I want this. She never does that. But if she were to say, here's what I'd like, and she gives me specific details about a specific thing, she'd like a particular kind of bag for hiking or something like that. I go, oh, okay, that's great, that's great. And so I decide, you know what, though? I think that what would be better for Lindsay is for me to invest in this other kind of, it is a rolling cart. I'm not trying to bring a cart, but like, this is something that goes with you, and it's just better. It's just better. It's, the point isn't that it's a cart. The point is that it's not what she asked for. So am I doing this for her, or am I doing this for me? And if you're Lindsay, or you've asked for a very specific thing, you've had a lot of thought and intention in this, and you asked for, I've researched it, this is the thing that I want, and then your parents or your friend, they're like, oh yeah, but I know better. You weren't listening. So we might say, I want to honor God, but if we're not doing what God has taken the time to tell us to do, are we really trying to honor God, or are we just doing it for ourselves? We're elevating our intellect and our ideas. That's not worship. It's just noise. No.
There's a particular verse that strikes me in this, and I'm not absolutely sure I'm reading it right. You can tell me. The 8th verse, then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. David was angry with God.
You might make the case that he's angry with the priests, which could be true, but I think he is frustrated with God. God, why did you do this? We're here celebrating you. This is the kingdom, and we're bringing you in. I mean, this is wonderful. And then you kill a man. But notice he's also not just angry, he's also afraid. So there's a complex response that he has toward God that's going to end in joy when he does it God's way. And it's interesting that the Bible records that.
Yeah.
David was angry with God.
Yeah.
David has a real relationship with God. And God can handle it if we're a little frustrated with him sometimes, provided that we're reverent and that we come to him on his terms. So I think that's an important thing to note. Amos?
This also seems like David's fault. He should have been like supervising this, making sure that they did it the right way, but he didn't do it right.
Yeah, there's several people here who could have taken responsibility, but don't. Meredith and then Mike.
Yeah, I'm just going to say the same thing. Like, David thought they were doing the right thing. So it's like what we said before, on first glance, you think like, oh, why is God killing this guy? They're doing the right thing. They're bringing it back. But
they
didn't do it right.
And note this too. We might feel bad for Uzzah. Let's keep in mind too that God doesn't often strike people dead. We don't know Uzzah. God knew Uzzah. And so God knew whether it was right to strike him dead or not. And we'll see often in the scriptures that God is patient with people when they don't get things right.
for whatever reason, he's not patient with Uzzah. And I think it may be, one, he knows Uzzah more than we do, but also this is a very important moment in the kingdom. And God is going to establish, I am king, and you need to revere me, and you have forgotten me for decades. As a nation, it is time to repent and remember that I am God. And so he's making a very plain declaration with Uzzah's death. Mike,
and then. It's going back into how it ended, especially in verse 14, I think it shows that David has a point. He can be angry as much as he wants, but the point has gotten across to where it's, okay, he actually has an ephod on. Doing the sacrifices, and once the card's moving, he goes, okay, now I get it.
Yeah.
Like, it's,
yeah.
He's gotten the point across, no matter how much you can kind of kick, scream, yeah. Get angry, but God made his point, and
yes.
David picked up on it.
You know, there is no person, no human on this planet that I delight in more than my wife. No one that makes me happy like my wife makes me happy. There's also no one on the planet that can make me angry like my wife can make me angry. And that's just, you draw close to someone like this, David's got this real relationship with God. And so when things are good, wow, everything's good. And he's dancing, he's leaping, he's joyful. When things are not good, yeah. I can be angry with lots of people. You know, that's not necessarily a good thing for me to say. But it's a different kind of thing when it's someone you're close to. And so David has this real relationship with God. He wants to be close to him, but there's a problem, and when it's resolved, look at the joy.
I don't know if this is correct. But someone's talking about manner and patterns of God. And I'm thinking, you know, God, I've learned that God is very purposeful in everything that he tells us to do. You mentioned the technology, something with the card or something. He told Moses one time to speak.
Right.
Moses comes back and does something different when he tells him, and that caused him. God has he may have a purpose and a reason.
Right.
And when we trust him, like today, people are doing what they want to do in worship. Because of their intellect and their, instead of the manner and the pattern, it can really mess up what God has intended for us, whether we get it at the moment or
right.
not.
Yeah.
So the best thing to do is obey him as he said.
That's right.
And not mess with his pattern or his manner in anything because it's purposeful.
Yeah, sometimes we don't know the specifics. God gives general instruction. Like, go into all the world and make disciples of men. That's general. I can go by boat, I can go by car, I can go by chariot, I can go by foot, I can go. If God has said, go by chariot, but he's being very general. But there are times where he's specific, and I may not always understand, to your point, I may not always understand why he's specific, but you see it back in Leviticus chapter 10, where Nadab and Abihu, I think in a worshipful way, are trying to offer to God incense. But it says they offered strange fire, unauthorized fire. So here's this sacrifice, and it wasn't done. Whatever was wrong about it, it wasn't the way God had said to do it. And so because of that, God strikes them dead. Very similar situation.
This guy at home with me, because having a discussion with this other brother, and you know, we're talking about conservative, liberal, within the brotherhood, so forth and so on. But the thing that strikes me is that, you know, whether we understand why God set things up the way they are or not, we need to do it his way because we're not in charge.
Right.
And that, you know, we could reason a lot of, well, we've been this, and really, if we didn't really mean, then here. But the bottom line, as by those two stories,
yeah.
We need to do it God's way.
Yeah, and that's not... Well, I'm afraid sometimes today we get the idea that, well, you're just trying to make it all about law and obedience. God is king, and he's a gracious king. And he's not just trying to tell us what to do so that he feels better about himself. He's got a bunch of people down here obeying him. His laws are for our good. And so we appreciate the kind of grace that he affords us in his commandments. And this relationship isn't just built on law, but it does include law. That's very important. I need to have this proper response. That is really all the time we have today, so we don't get to see the finish of this.
But any closing thoughts or questions or comments as we wrap up here?
I would just say, somebody asked about whether David was actually Andrew 1. I think he was.
Yeah, I think so.
And it just shows all humanity, because there are so many situations where, you know, we hear it around,
yeah,
where we get angry with God. But at the end of the day, we have to remember the sovereignty of God, and God will do what he pleases to do because he is sovereign.
Right, that's right.
And, you know, and that's something that we have to contemplate as not humanity.
Yeah, there's, I still need to come to terms that he is God, he is king, so I can be angry and worshipful. So I need to remember he's God. Yeah. What else said? Amos?
Sometimes it may seem like God is unfair, like here with us, like, why'd you strike him dead? He was trying to do what he thought was right. Or with Manasseh, why didn't you strike him dead? He was a very sinful man. But he's knows exactly what he's doing. He is very gracious, and he has a purpose.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. We'll pick up here in verse 12 next time. Bad place to stop, but it's where we are. So thank you so much for the discussion. Next time, Lord willing, prepare with your study guides for chapter 7. So we'll finish up 6 and get into 7. Let's close with a prayer. Our God in heaven, thank you for your word, and thank you for teaching us how to live and how it is that you want us to obey you, so that we can treat you in a holy way and we can be made better. Please work in us and help us to grow. Help us to have a loving concern for those around us who may not understand or may not see you the way that you are. Help us to be patient and compassionate. We know that you want to save all people. Please help us to have a good week, remembering your purpose for us. Please equip us and bless us and be with us. So in the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.